This morning we begin a new series called Family Relationships. We realize that we have taught on that topic before. We have a few tapes on family relationships, spirit, soul and body. We want to talk about family relationships in the Bible and consider Bible families and principles involved in establishing good families, strong families. And it is an important aspect because many times people move into the gifts of God, the talents of God, but when it all comes down to where the rubber hits the road, to the brass tacks of life, after all that they have done, they may receive adulation, recognition, and success outside, with thousands of people being blessed. But there is a concept of loneliness that comes when everything is over, and the church service is over, or the talents in your life and ministry, or your business is successful, or your ministry is successful, and once everything is over, and you go back, and you have a broken home. It can be the most frustrating thing in your life. And you'll find that no matter how much success you have on the outside, when you don't have success on the inside, it still doesn't satisfy. Especially many who sometimes on the outward side, everything is going alright. But right in their homes, where the day-to-day affairs of this life are ironed out, where they have to be 24 hours almost every day, maybe 16 hours of the time that they spend, and this unhappiness there is going to be eating up their talents, eating up their gifting in God. And so we want to look at some families in the Bible. First of all, we want to consider five types of family problems in the Bible. Five types of family problems before we point to an ideal family relationship in the Bible. So let's consider first of all, in the book of Genesis, there's quite a number of them from the book of Genesis. One area of family relationship problems, and we're talking in terms of Christian families, is where worldliness comes in. And the carnal and the flesh and fleshly covetous desires supersede the desire for a real solid home. And many families are trying to keep up with the Joneses, and they spend so much time trying to earn more money, and they neglected one of the most precious things in their life, their family. After they have caught up with the Joneses, they found that they have no more family to share their joy, and that will be the saddest event in their life. So here's a family in the Bible. The first family we consider with a great family problem is the family of Lot and his wife. Lot was a very worldly man. He was in the Lord because he was part of the covenant of the Lord with Abraham's blessing. But yet, there's something in him that still go after the world. And if he has to choose between having more time with the family or having more money, he will choose more money. And if he has to choose between having a promotion that has another extra $1,000, but having another 4 hours left with the family, they would choose that. And if they had to choose, for example, having to be transferred away somewhere with another $5,000 increment, but they would not be with their family for 3 times or 4 times a week, they would choose those kind of choices. That can cause a family tension. And so we have here Lot, and let's see some of his personality in the book of Genesis, chapter 13. This is the kind of man that Lot is. And as long as worldliness is in the hearts of either the husband or the wife, the father or the mother, there will definitely be tension. Sometimes it's on the husband's side. They are worldly and they go for worldly position, worldly money, and they equate that as greater than family relationships. Sometimes it's the wife's side, and they're never satisfied with whatever the husband brings home. And they have a good husband, but he doesn't earn as much, and a good character, a good children, and everything is nice, a reasonable flats or apartments, a home, but they want something more in life. They want to keep up with Mrs. Jones. And as a result, they're never satisfied, and nagging the husband, get more, work more, push the children, etc. And there's tension in the home. Worldliness can either be in a husband's life or in a wife's life. For the children, they pick up what the parents have. So that's how children also can become worldly. In the book of Genesis chapter 13, Abraham and Lot were having a difficult relationship together. And Abraham was gracious. He said, "Lord, if you will take the right, I will take the left. If you choose whichever land, I give you first choice, even though he's younger. And I'll take the opposite." And Lot, in verse 10, Lot lifted up his eyes and saw all the plain of Jordan, that it was well watered everywhere, before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt, as you go towards Zoar. Then Lot chose for himself all the plain of Jordan, and Lot journeyed east, and they separated from each other. Now, this was the type of person that Lot was. He made his decisions based on what he sees, not based on his prayer life and relationship with God. Besides that, he makes his decision based on how much more he will gain carnally, naturally, not spiritually. Before you make a choice to accept a new job or to accept a transfer, you must not only consider all the fringe benefits in the natural or all the financial increments, you must also evaluate the spiritual consideration. Then you put them all together, make a good decision. Lot is the type of person who only consider the natural area. So he went next to Sodom and Gomorrah, live in that area. In chapter 19 of Genesis, outwardly everything seems to be much better. They prospered, they have a home of their own, and everything looks well, except that the influence upon his children, the influence upon his home, was not good. Which things he didn't consider. All he thought about was migrating to that area. He did not think about spiritual influence. He talked about physical affluence. Affluence. In chapter 19, finally Sodom and Gomorrah had to be destroyed. And in chapter 19, two angels were sent out to meet Lot in verse 1. Now the two angels came to Sodom in the evening, and Lot was sitting in the gate of Sodom. When Lot saw them, he rose to meet them, and he bowed himself with his face toward the ground. And he said, "Hear now, my lords, please turn into your servant's house, and spend the night, and wash your feet, that you may rise early and go on your way." See, there are certain things that are good about Lot. In the natural, you will find him a very nice man. There are many nice people out there in the world, with the exception that they have not come to know the Lord. Lord is a very nice person, basically. Hospitable, gracious, but worldly. So when the man says here in verse 2, the last phrase, they say, "No, but we will spend the night in the open square." Verse 3, Lot knows how dangerous it was. He insisted strongly as they turned in to him and entered his house. Then he made them a feast and baked unleavened bread, and they ate. Now before they lay down, the men of the city, the men of Sodom, both old and young, all the people from every quarter surrounded the house. They called to Lot and said, "Where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us, that we may know them carnally." That was the type of condition they live in. He would rather have all the fields and all the fertile valleys plus all this bad influence. Verse 6, Lot went to them and said, "Please," in verse 7, "don't do wickedly." And in verse 8, look at the kind of person Lot was. "I have two daughters who have not known a man. Please let me bring them out to you, that you may do to them as you wish. Only do nothing to the men, since this is the reason they have come under the shadow of my roof." Worldliness will lead to the willingness to sacrifice your family on the altar of success. Lot was willing to sacrifice his two daughters. What a man. It doesn't begin straight away. I'm sure Lot was quite a good family man. But what happens is these things eat on your inside a bit at a time. No person becomes cruel overnight. Slowly, their heart grows colder. And as it grows colder, they are more willing to take harsh decisions, painful things, painful afflictions upon others become of no more feelings to them. He reached a point where he could sacrifice his two daughters just so he could have a good hospitality to these two persons. How could he reach to that stage? Worldliness. Finally, as they continue in verse 9, they press hard against Lot, trying to break down the door. And look at verse 9. When the people in a town could not get what they want, they say, "We will do worse with you than with them." Lot himself was about to be attacked. Finally, in verse 10, the two angels reach out and pull Lot into the house, and they rescue Lot. But verse 12 says, "Have you anyone else here, son-in-law, your sons, your daughters, whomever you have in the city, take them out of this place, for we will destroy this place." Then verse 14, Lot went out, spoke to his sons-in-laws who had married his daughters, and said, "Get up, get out of this place, for the Lord will destroy this city." But to his sons-in-law, he seemed to be joking. This was the type of people whom Lot lived with. He even married his two daughters to his other daughters to these sons-in-law. And these are not people who knew the Lord. Finally, when nobody departs, in verse 15, when the morning dawned, the angels urged Lot to hurry, saying, "Arise, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, lest you be consumed in the punishment of the city." And as they ran forth out of the city, even when they ran forth, Lot already lost at least two daughters. Remember, if he said he has two daughters who are not married, who were staying with him, and he has two daughters who have already married son-in-laws, at least, we are not sure whether there are two, but since it's plural, the minimum is two. At least two, maybe more, who have married people of Sodom and Gomorrah. That means that even as they ran, he already lost two daughters, at least, the minimum, maybe more. Because the daughters who have married the son-in-laws did not want to follow Lot. They follow their husband, who said that Lot must be joking. He must be joking. How can this place be burned up? Family problems, divisions, and suffering do come when a family chooses the road of worldliness. In the end, as Lot ran out, his wife, who has also picked up his worldly character, look back for a moment, perhaps to mourn the loss. They have lost all their house, all their possessions. They only ran away with the clothes on their back. That's all they have. And as they ran away, the wife must be feeling like most people who lose valuable things, very, in our Malaysian way, very sayang. Ayo, all these things gone. All the life investments, everything is gone. In the end, Lot not only lose his family, he lost the worldly possessions too. When you try to establish a family with worldliness in the heart, you stand not only to lose your family, you stand to also lose the success. Why? Because by the time you have lost your family, there's a hole in your heart. You have no more motivation to work hard, no more motivation to pursue success in a way God wants it. It doesn't satisfy anymore. Many people have started changing when they lost a family after they tried to go for the world. People like, for example, Elvis Presley, the singer. He could have given his talents to God in his early days, but he chose to walk the way of the world. And everything looks rosy until one day his family broke up. When his wife left him, it is said from that time onwards, Elvis was a different man. He had no more family, in a sense. He may have hundreds of people who would sleep with him, but he had no more belonging in a family. He changed. He became like a different person. He's no more that family man. He just went all the way and he died a horrible death. It seems that noble haste brought him to the Lord before he died, but we do not know. But what a waste of a life. In the end, he lost everything. In the same way, Lord lost everything. And within one day, there was two daughters, and Lot became a widower. He lost his wife. Nothing left but the clothes on his back. So that kind of problems in the home can only be solved by God coming into the home and having the rightful place in the home, where the family members give their heart to Jesus, and where the home has Jesus as Lord, where gold is not the Lord, but Jesus is the Lord. And any family decision is taken with the counsel of the whole family and saying, look here, is this worthy? Is that worthy? And the family gains as a whole, not just individuals in the family gain. First type of family problem, worldliness. Second type of possible family problem, let's look over here in the book of Genesis. And this time, we look in Abraham's own life. Abraham had some family problems in his life. Chapter 16, Abraham and Sarah apparently never really had a real quarrel that was recorded. They may have normal misunderstandings that they clear up, normal harmonizing as necessary in any relationship, but there was no recorded quarrel between Sarah and Abraham, even during those times when Abraham was telling a lie to preserve his own life. There's no real problems. They seem to cooperate very well together. But one day something changed. In chapter 16, verse 1, Sarai, Abraham's wife, had borne him no children. And she had an Egyptian maidservant whose name was Hagar. So Sarai said to Abraham, see now, the Lord has restrained me from bearing children. Please go in to my maid. Perhaps I shall obtain children by her. And Abraham heeded the voice of Sarai. Then Sarai, Abraham's wife, took Hagar, her maid, the Egyptian, and gave her to her husband Abraham to be his wife, after Abraham had dwelt 10 years in the land of Canaan. Verse 4. When he went into Hagar, she conceived. And then when she saw that she had conceived, her mistress became despised in her eyes. The second type of family problems is when third parties become involved. Third parties will mean people outside the family. And here Hagar became a third party in a relationship. And we are not just talking about necessary fornication or a sinful relationship, but the third party could be the mother-in-law, the father-in-law, a parent-in-law, or could be your uncle who is a bit nosy into your family, an auntie who is a busybody, or some close friend who was your blood brother or sister, and now feels neglected now that you are married, or something. A third party becomes involved in that family. And as long as that family has not settled the issue and said, look here, as far as the family is concerned, it's important to remember that third parties should never contribute to the quarrels. And I know sometimes in some families that many of their quarrels are not about each other. I know a family, not here, but from another place, and they do have quarrels, and I sat down and counseled with them, and they said these words. Not that their quarrels, they have never quarreled with each other in the sense of a quarrel. They may have some misunderstanding that they clear up, things to harmonize, but they don't really have a quarrel. But when other people started coming into their lives, that was when they started quarreling. Not in the sense of fornication, but in the sense of the husband wants to get involved in certain things in among his friends, and the wife feels this is not right, this is not wrong, this is wrong, etc. The quarrel started, and it became a constant life of quarrel. How miserable it is to live in a family where you quarrel every day and every week. That is why they say that a family life can either be heaven or hell. It becomes heaven when everything is peaceful, love, joy, and peace flow. But it becomes hell because every day you have to endure it for the rest of your life. And so how horrible it is when a third party becomes involved, this time through Sarai's initiation. So Abraham and Sarah began to have problems. Look at some of their quarrels and misunderstanding. In chapter 17, chapter 21, Sarah constantly feel insecure from that day onwards. In verse 8, and the child grew and was weaned, and Abraham made a great feast for the same day that Isaac was weaned. Now they have children in a family. There was Ishmael, there was Isaac, there was Hagar, she was still around. Verse 9, Sarah saw the son of Hagar, the Egyptian, whom she had borne to Abraham, scoffing. Then in verse 11, verse 10, Sarah said, cast out this born woman. Verse 11, that was against Abraham's nature. Sometimes we have that problem where it could be, when we are talking about nuclear families, sometimes it could be on the father's side, or the who wants to extend the nuclear family to take care of more people. I know a certain minister in the United States where he has a habit of once in a while, without informing his wife, that is his problem, he should have informed and asked first. He would just bring in strangers for meals. And always, there was always people coming into their home. And he could go out, and then he would suddenly bring back about 20 hippies. The wife tolerated that for 5 years. Until one day the wife broke down. She cannot. She couldn't. See, what should have happened, they should have communicated to each other and see the extent. What happens here is Abraham was willing to have a compassionate look. Sometimes it's on the wife side. Sometimes perhaps the wife may want to help some people here and there. Then the husband feels insecure. And what happens in this second type of problem is that either the husband or the wife begins to feel that their love, the love of their husband or wife for them, is being removed, diverted from them. So insecure feelings come, which is very common. And as a result, quarrels start. And usually when within a family, when people, the husband or the wife, want some attention, they don't get it directly. They may say, if the husband comes back late, they say, where have you been? What have you been doing? It is not because they want to know where you have been, what have you been doing. It's that they are telling you, you did not spend time with me. These are all what I call secondary ways of putting what they want. And it could be the opposite. Sometimes it's the husband who is the jealous one. And he's saying, where do you go? What do you do? It's not that they're wanting to know where they go and what they do only, although that may be one of the areas, but behind it is that you have not been giving me enough attention. You have not been loving me enough. So, when a third party comes into a relationship, it could be perhaps even the in-laws. Maybe the husband wants to take care of the in-laws, but the wife says, the in-law come in, I go out. So the husband feels frustrated. He wants to take care of his parents, but his wife doesn't want to take care. Why? The wife may have a reason, because the parents are always ridiculing her. Things like that. And this leads to a family problem where if they have never have a third party come in, they would have one of the sweetest relationships in the world. Isn't it sad that sometimes people have to quarrel over other people? Where if they had been alone to themselves, they would have been the greatest of lovers. Where's the problem here? When Sarah wanted to get rid of Hagar, Abraham was not very happy. In chapter 21 verse 11, the matter was very displeasing in Abraham's sight because of his son. You see, Abraham still loved Ishmael, because Ishmael was actually still his son. But Sarah knew her blood and her flesh is never in Ishmael. But Abraham knew that even though this was a child that came from Hagar, Abraham's seed was also in Ishmael. And there are many times when Abraham said, God bless Ishmael. That love was still there. His natural compassion was still there. And he didn't like it. He didn't like what Sarah was going to do. But God deal with Abraham. God deal with Abraham. The solution for it, the one who started it, has to be the one who solved the problem. And then the one, both parties must give in to a certain area. You see here that in chapter 16 verse 1, the whole thing was initiated by Sarah. Sarah was the one who started the whole thing. And so when Abraham was unhappy, in verse 12 of chapter 21, Genesis, God said to Abraham, do not let it be displeasing in your sight because of the lad or because of your bondwoman. Whatever Sarah has said to you, listen to her voice, for in Isaac your seed shall be called. Yet I will make a nation of the son of the bondwoman because he is your seed. Now you can see the solution. The first area, the one who created it in the first place, had a greater responsibility to solve it. That is Sarah. Although when she solved it, it looks a bit cruel. Abraham's part was to temper it. If Sarah were the one who were to send Hagar out with Ishmael, she would have just chased them out. But Abraham tempered it. God said, Abraham, you must allow Sarah to solve that problem. You must allow Sarah to do what she wants. Look at what Abraham did. Not Sarah, but Abraham. Verse 14. Abraham rose early in the morning, took bread and a skin of water, putting it on her shoulder, he gave it and the boy to Hagar and sent her away. Do you notice a beautiful relationship here? That although Sarah started and had a responsibility to solve the problem. She was the one who proposed the solution. They recognized Heshi in the family. It was Abraham who took responsibility to send send Hagar away. I want you to know that's not an easy thing to do. He's not just sending Ishmael to school, to boarding school. He's sending them out into the wilderness, not knowing where they are going. It would be equivalent to sending perhaps your own child, packing them with whatever food necessary and saying goodbye to them for the rest of their life. That's not easy on Abraham. But Abraham had to be realistic and recognize that if Hagar and Ishmael remain, there will be no solution. There will be no solution. There will be constant quarrel. Part of the problem was also related to Hagar and Ishmael. You see here, if the third party did not, the third party coming in is already a problem, but the third party also make a nuisance of themselves. You can see here in chapter 16, Hagar, who had always been a very respectful maidservant, in verse 4, suddenly she began to think she is better than Sarah, and she began to take the wrong attitude. She began to despise Sarah, something that she has never done in her life. Besides that, in chapter 21, in verse 9, Sarah saw the son of Hagar, that is Ishmael, scoffing at Isaac. Ishmael also contributed to the problem. They know that they are already a problem, they should not have make it worse. It's just like sometimes you may not realize what traveling ministry goes through. Sometimes when I travel, I realize how much I inconvenience other lives. Some of them had to take leave to chauffeur me around, and we appreciate all these things. But love doesn't take advantage. And a lot of people offer to chauffeur around and take the airport, even locally here. But I'm conscious of the fact that for people to do that, they take time from their work. I know that they enjoy doing it sometimes, and they really do. Is an honor to them, but then love doesn't take advantage. I realize the disadvantage sometimes, and so sometimes when we stay with families, we try as best as possible to minimize the inconvenience. And sometimes we stay in the family, we purposely go and get our own food, take care of our own self, say no problem, just leave us here, we take care of ourselves. So we are already intruding into the privacy of the family, and we are always around the house, they won't feel so private. And besides that, we don't want to intrude and inconvenience the family. So we try to minimize the inconvenience when we stay with our family. But there are sometimes men of God who, when they travel, sometimes with their family, it's harder to stay with other people. And they would stay in a home, not only do they invade the privacy, the inconvenience. They stay in the home and they want to be like the king and the big boss. They say, could you get me this? Could you get me that? Could you do this for me? Could you confirm my ticket for me? Could you do this? Could you do that? Know that these people will serve you. But then we realize, if possible, try not to inconvenience them. So here is where Ishmael and Hagar were already intruding into the private life of Abraham and Sarah. And they should have thought carefully and said, look, we are already intruding into a relationship. Let's make ourselves a blessing rather than make ourselves an inconvenience. Instead of making themselves a blessing, maybe Hagar should have taken this attitude. Hagar should have said, it's so good of my mistress to allow me to bear this child. I'm very grateful. And she should have served more. She has sought to please more. She has sought to serve more, sought to humble herself more. Instead, she became proud. In the same way with Ishmael. He should have seen, you know, how wonderful it is to grow up as one of Abraham's child, which all the other servants did not have a chance. He was, although he was not Sarah's child, he was Abraham's child, and Abraham did love him too. And so, instead of making things easier for Sarah, he made it harder for himself and for Hagar by going around, who is Isaac? And take a wrong attitude instead of being grateful and say how thankful he is to be with Abraham. Even whatever little Abraham, know that he cannot be the kind of child that Isaac is. He cannot have the same privilege as Isaac. But thank God for whatever he has. He forgot to thank God for what he has. He became insecure and he became a scoffer. In the end, the third party lost everything. They were removed out of the relationship. That would have been the only possible way, as I look through the thing, for the thing to keep in harmony. But because Hagar and Ishmael refused to cooperate, they lost everything. And then Abraham and Sarah's relationship was back to normal. Not exactly the way God wants it now, but at least the third party was removed out of the situation. So family problems can be caused by third party. If perhaps it's your wife-in-law or your husband-in-law, you have to sit down and discuss the issue properly and seek a solution. And remember, there is no such thing as one party having their own way. You would have to negotiate a reasonable compromise, not on principle, but on methods. For example, if the husband wants to take care of the in-laws, the wife refused, then take care of them outside the home, not inside the home. If the wife says, in-laws in, I'm out, then you better let the in-laws be out and the wife be in. Or if it's the opposite, if the wife says, in-laws are coming in, the husband says, in-laws in, I'm out, let the in-laws be out, take care of them in a different way, in a different sense. And for the minister I quoted, who brought home all kinds of hippies for food, he should have consulted with his wife and find out to what extent his wife can take it and mediate a reasonable settlement and say, alright, this time at this place this is possible, at other times no, because you need your private time too, instead of being a cook for everybody. So third party problems can come in. Number three, the third type of family problems that can come. Let's look over now at Isaac's life. We see also in the book of Genesis, chapter 25, Isaac married Rebekah. And verse 21, chapter 25 verse 21, Genesis. Now Isaac pleaded with the Lord for his wife because she was barren, and the Lord granted his plea, and Rebekah his wife conceived. But the children struggled together within her, and she said, if all is well, why am I this way? So she went to inquire of the Lord, and the Lord said to her, two nations are in your womb. So they have twins in the womb. Finally, when these twins come forth, in verse 25, the first came out red, he was like a hairy garment all over, so they called his name Esau. Afterward, his brother came out, and his hand took hold of Esau's heel, so his name was called Jacob. Isaac was 60 years old when she bore them. He married about 40 odd. So the boys grew, and Esau was a skillful hunter, a man of the field, but Jacob was a mild man dwelling in tents. Isaac loved Esau because he ate of his game, but Rebekah loved Jacob. The third type of family problem is where we call what we call a personality conflict, and it can involve children, where sometimes husbands and wives are in perfect harmony. When the children started coming, they may have different ways of bringing up children. And you will probably be experienced in life to know that although we have a set of principles on bringing up children, every child is different. Every child is different. And then everybody's personality is different. Every child's personality is different. There are some basic principles, but it's very common for families to judge one another and say, I think you should have brought the child up this way. And another family next time judge the other and say, I think you should have brought your child the other way. And to make matters worse, sometimes within the same family, the husband and wife got different ways of bringing up children because of their personality. Sometimes it could be suggestions, proposals, or commandments from the in-laws. These are the thou shall bring the child up this way. Influence that come forth. So the third source of problem is what I call a conflict of personalities and principles, which involves methods. I realize because of my personality, I'm the type who like to explore. And I like to bring up children without raising voice and trying to give them a chance to discover things. And give them a lot of opportunities. I like to draw out intelligence from their lives. I like to invite questions. But then I realize that sometimes other families don't take that approach. And a child asks too much questions, they get irritated, they shut up and listen. That's not the approach I take. But I realize that it flows from personality because of the type of leaning in our mind. My mind is scientific. I tend to draw out different aspects from a child. And so a person may grow up in a military home. And from small, they have always been given commandments. But their stronger asset is obedience. And so they instill that upon their children. So their children are always very, very quiet. Never make noise. Still as a statue. And everything. But when they start comparing their child with, for example, my child who is taught to explore, taught to go around, taught to ask questions, and etc. And they say, hey, your child doesn't know obedience and seems to be a different thing. It's a different way of upbringing, producing different personality in the children, besides having different children or different personality. We have basic things. Christian principles, prayer, the word, knowledge of Jesus, all this must be placed into the child. Then we realize that there are differences within different families. How much more sometimes the problem is compounded when a husband and a wife disagree. My wife and I have sat down and we said, these are the ways we will bring out our children. We discussed. There were some points of disagreement, but we negotiated until we find a compromise. Perhaps some of you have never sat down and discussed. But we have discussed. And we say, alright, these are the ways. Some of you, no families yet, and so never face that kind of situation. But you may be counseling some people who have that problem. But we realize in some homes, children begin to take sides because of the different principles and different personality of the parents themselves. So what happened? Look at their family relationship. Isaac loved Esau. Rebecca loved Jacob. And the one reason that it tells you why Isaac loved Esau is because Esau cooked his favorite meal. And Esau could get deer meat, which was the way into his heart. You say a way into a man's heart is through his belly. But they are talking about carnal men. Because spiritual men fast a lot, so they hardly have any bellies. Whereas Rebecca loved Jacob because Jacob was a houseman. He was always helping in the kitchen. And she feed Jacob a lot. So she grew to love Jacob more than Esau. And that is already wrong. If you have more than one child, 2, 3, 4, 5, 12, 20, 25, 30. It is wrong to love one child above the other. Although I realize that different child of different ages get different privileges,
But that has to be explained to the child. I explain to my children because of the age difference. I say, look here, she's older, she can do this, you can't. And she's given this privilege, you're not. When you grow up, you will have the same privilege. No problem. And then the older one has to say, look, you're older, you have to learn to give in a bit more because you understand, they don't quite understand that much. So there are different things that we discuss, negotiate with the children to give them understanding. It is wrong to love one child above the other. All the children must know. Privileges may be different. The 21-year-old child would have a different privilege from the 16-year-old than from the 8-year-old. But love must be the same. Privileges are different, but love is the same. We know the problem in Jacob's life. See, Jacob had a problem in his home. Now Jacob has his own family. He loved Joseph above all the other children. That created family tension. I'm sure you notice little children. When one of the child has attention of the father or mother, the other also want the same attention. Children fight for attention, they fight for love. If the attention is given equally and all the children know they are loved equally, then it's a harmonious home. But if the children grow up knowing that they are not loved as much, they are of a lesser privilege and love than the other for no reason except that they are just loveless, it's going to create tension. And I know families who have quarreled over bringing up children. Families who have quarreled over love for the children. It's a source of constant problems. Solution, you have to iron out your personality and you have to iron out your principles. You have not ironed them out, you are sweeping things under the carpet. We must accept one another's personality. You don't marry a person to change a person's personality. You accept a person as they are. Then principles can be discussed. And the methods and the timing of implementing can be compromised, but not the principles themselves. But they have to be negotiated. I'm surprised how many families never discuss about things like that. I don't know what they do. Husband goes out, work, comes back. Wife cooks, then take care of the children, sleeps. That's all they do. They don't discuss. They don't negotiate. They don't stretch out over principles, over methods, etc. As a result, there's constant strife in the home. So stretch out personality differences, stretch out principles, so that there could be some changes. The fourth type of problem that can come, let's look over in the book of this time we look in the book of 1 Samuel. First Samuel we look at the relationship between David and Michael. The fourth type of problems that can come in a family relationship, it all started beautifully in 1 Samuel when they fell in love. Bible tells us, chapter 18, 1 Samuel chapter 18, verse 22, chapter 18, 1 Samuel. Now Michael, Saul's daughter, loved David, and they told Saul, and the thing pleased him. So Saul said, I will give her to him, that she may be a snare to him, and that the hand of the Philistines may be against him. Therefore Saul said to David a second time, "You shall be my son-in-law today." And Saul commanded his servants to communicate with David secretly and say, "Look, the king has delighted in you, and all his servants love you. Now therefore become the king's son-in-law." So Michael loved David, and David also possibly loved Michael. David paid a price for his bride, and in verse 27, the last verse, last phrase, "Then Saul gave him Michael, his daughter, as wife." Thus Saul saw and knew that the Lord was with David, and that Michael, Saul's daughter, loved him. So David started very well in his relationship with Michael. But as their relationship grew, there were circumstances that separated them. Saul pursued David, David ran away. And Michael really did love David and help David to escape. That's found also in 1 Samuel. And David fled away in chapter 20, verse 1. He fled from Nahor to Ramah and ran and said to Jonathan, "What have his father done to pursue him?" In his fleeing, chapter 19, verse 12, Michael is the one who let David down through a window and helped him to escape, preserve his life, because Michael loved David. But you know, notice something about that relationship. Michael was a princess, and she didn't do much, quote unquote, to earn David. David did all the work at the risk of his life to earn the hand of Michael. In fairy tales, it would have been a lovely story, and they lived happily ever after. How the prince conquered dragons, conquered Philistines, and conquer insurmountable odds, and wins the hand of the princess, who is seated all the time in her dark feather pillow and dark feather cushion, waiting for the prince on a white horse to come and win her hand. You would have thought that it was a beautiful relationship, but there's a problem there. Wherever a relationship is one-sided, and the work to build that relationship is one-sided, after the wedding day, there will be problems, because the one who is so used to being won will be seated on the chair waiting to be loved and making no effort at loving back. So even before the marriage, even though Michael loved him, it was David who paid all the price, risked his own life. And that kind of relationship is one-sided. I'm sure you may have met sometimes a man who falls in love with a beautiful girl. The beautiful girl knows nothing about cooking, knows nothing about work, but only knows how to make her nails and paint her face. But the man falls in love, pays every price he knows, woos her for about 2 years. Finally, by hook and by crook, he got her. And he thought that he would live happily ever after. 1 year after the marriage, lo and behold, he found out that she would rather paint her nails than cook the food. She would rather command the maid than bring up the children. Then he realized he has not chosen a wife. He has chosen a model. And she wants to remain a model all her life. So that relationship has been one-sided all the time. And that so-called person whom he married is demanding that one-sided relationship after the marriage. It's not a healthy situation. There will be frustration. There will be problems. Sometimes it's the other way around. The girl does everything. Falls in love. The man not so interested. So she checks his schedule. Make sure in every meeting is there, she's there. Make sure that she's always next to him. Shows herself. Every party he goes to, she's there. Makes herself very available. Puts on the strongest perfume box by him. got a few handkerchiefs along the way. That's everything. Chase, woo, leaders, recruit friends to get their relationship sealed. Sometimes it doesn't work. Sometimes it works. Lo and behold, one day he looks and he marries her. But there's one thing. She has done all the chasing. She has done 99% of the chasing. He has done 1% of the taking out his hand. She thought that after she marries him, he will be a good husband. But there's a problem. Even before they were married, the relationship was built one-sided. Even though he reluctantly agreed to get married, it was built on one side. You still have a lot of things to iron out. So after about 1 year of marriage, the wedding bells are all gone. He's still the same. He wants to be the kind of husband who's like the big boss. And his wife is not a wife. His wife is servant. Comes home, polish the shoes. Where's the meal? Bring the papers here. How are the children? Did you do your job? He's a boss all the time. Doesn't offer his hand to help. Doesn't help with the children. Doesn't help with the house. Oh, he's just a boss. He's used to being wooed and won. Sadly, the rest of her life, she tried to change him. She did not succeed. Because the relationship is one-sided. You see, when two parties pay a price for the relationship, after the wedding, they are prepared to keep paying the price. Where it's only one side paying the price for the marriage, it will be one-sided all along the way unless something changes. There you have Michael. Later when David, who still loved Michael, called her back in 2 Samuel chapter 3, he asked for Michael back in verse 14. David sent messengers to Ish-bosheth, Saul's son, saying, give me my wife Michael, whom I betrothed to myself. And so he got Michael back, but Michael is still the princess. She's still used to the princess way. So in chapter 6, when David had brought the ark and he was happy and he celebrated, in verse 20, chapter 6 verse 20, David returned to bless his household, and Michal, the daughter of Saul, came out to meet David and said, how glorious was the king of Israel today, uncovering himself today in the eyes of the maids of his servant. You see, what she was, she wanted David to be. She wanted David to be the dignified king. All the subjects at his feet. He doesn't want David to dance, celebrate the way a king should not. Because she is a princess. Not only that, she's quite used to David doing all the things for her. And so she wants to sit down and say, David, you should be doing this. David, you should be doing that. See, the princess syndrome was still in her life. It may be good to marry a princess, but remember that they must have Jesus kind of compassion and heart. Marry a princess, marry a prince by all means, but make sure they are princess and prince, not just in the blood, but in character, in servitude. So here, their relationship was never smooth. Michael is used to being pampered, and David refused to give that pampering. Problems. From that day onwards, David never was with Michael anymore. The relationship didn't work. See, it's kind of a problem in relationships. In the book of Exodus chapter 2, when Moses wanted to obey the Lord and go to the land of Egypt, God had commanded him to circumcise his sons. But somehow, Moses did not do it because Zipporah was against it. So that the first thing that Moses came across when God called him was a family quarrel. He wants to serve God, but his wife doesn't want to serve God the same way. A fifth part of family problem is a problem of commitment to God. Different from worldliness. Both could be Christians. One wants to go full time, the other doesn't want to go. Sometimes, if one is a believer, the other is an unbeliever. Problem of religion. This can create tension. Doctrinal issues. When I first met my wife in seminary, one of the first problems we had was doctrinal issue. Can you imagine it? Doctrinal issue. I was charismatic and a bit charismaniac. She was Baptist all the way. So we had doctrinal issues at all. She could not stand a charismatic. Praise God, today she is a charismatic. I had to pray Ephesians 1 for her for 1 year. I thought one day, when an evangelist comes to town, I couldn't be the one. It has to be somebody else. She attends a meeting, got filled with the Spirit, and I say, bless God, now we have passed the first hurdle, doctrinal issues. Doctrinal issues can sometimes come in the way of a relationship. Sometimes, when in husband and wife relationship, maybe one is more open to certain doctrine, it may be charismatic or anti-charismatic, it may be prophetic move, healing way. The husband wants to go healing way, praise the Lord, no medicine, because Jesus is now our doctor, our family doctor. The wife says, cannot. Doctrinal issues, spiritual issues, all come in to cause family conflict. What to do about these issues? There's only one area, let God deal with the issue. You need to let God deal with the issue. And number two, the timing of God is involved. But remember, there are some things that cannot be compromised, which Moses found out to his near disaster. Because when you talk about God and you talk about the things of God, there are some things that cannot be compromised. Bible cannot be compromised. And that is where husbands and wives, if your husband or wife is not a believer and they ask you to smoke, drink or do things that you know doesn't glorify the temple of God, you must say no. It's better to die and be with Jesus than to live and displease Jesus. There are some things that are not negotiable. Some things are negotiable. So you must strike a balance in your relationship. Same with my relationship with my wife. We discussed some things and I said, all the church issues and all the church problems is something I will not talk to you about. Because you cannot carry my burden. You'll be worrying. I can take the burdens because the grace of God is there. And I said, you can't open all the letters unless I say so. These letters. You see, some wives are, not my wife, but some wives are busybodies. They enter your husband's office, open all their husband's drawers, open the letters. I mean, if you suspect your husband of fornication is a different thing. But where that doesn't come in, some wives are just nosy. They want every part to do. Hey, your work, did you approve the contract or not? What has that to do with you, wife? You're not a businesswoman, you're a wife. If you approve the contract for him, do you want to fulfill the contract? You see, we all must discover our place. There are some doctrinal issues, there are some work issues, there are some things to do with principles that are not negotiable. And so we draw a line. I'll say, look here, these are the lines. Any letters to you, family, here they are. And pick some things I do share. Sometimes I need a woman's point of view. And so I will ask from her side, what do you think about this? What do you think about that? And the same way I told my wife, I said, as far as you're concerned, and as far as the children's ministry is concerned, or whatever department you work, you know, it's yours. If you want to consult with me, you can ask, but I will not come and disturb you and say, I don't think you should approve this person, that person, I think you should choose this. I will not meddle, in other words. So we all need to know our lines so that there can be harmony in the home. Harmony in the home. Like sometimes some of you could be involved in certain church areas, and then your wife says, hey, tell me everything about it, tell me everything about this and that. I say, praise the Lord. That's why if you ask my wife and say, what does your husband share with you? Almost nothing. Almost nothing. And when she asked me about meeting, I said, praise the Lord. Good meeting? Yes, good meeting. And she hears all the testimonies from all the others. And it's because we try to keep the relationship right. See, I'm the one who is called to pastor the church, not her, although she is behind me. And she may be called to different areas. And we must recognize, if your husband is a director, your husband is somewhere, someplace, remember, you're the wife. You're not to tell him how to do his business. Do you want to change roles? He stay at home, you do the business? You can't, because your gifting is different. But of course, all women have a hunger and an appetite for information. So I do budget certain times. When I sit with my wife and I say, all right, you can ask any question you want. Question time. And we'll talk late into the night. And discuss things and talk about things. And husbands, you need to learn to communicate and discuss. So some things, some doctrinal things, some situations that cannot be compromised. And you have to have God come into the picture to harmonize the whole. You need to pray for your husband or your wife if they are not in the Lord. And remember, there will be definitely some areas you cannot compromise. Sometimes it has to do with commitment to the Lord. Husband or wife want to serve the Lord and one party doesn't feel ready. Then you have to hold yourself back. You have to go at the other person's pace. Perhaps the husband wants to leave without medicine. The wife doesn't want. So you have to see at which level you got to negotiate your home. I know many homes where they quarrel over things like whether to see the doctor, especially stay homes. And they quarrel about different issues and different areas and different things. They quarrel. It's unnecessary to quarrel. All you have to do is to draw up and negotiate correctly the area where you all could stand together. And believe me, you will find some common ground to stand together. There will always be certain issues and doctrines and principles where you can find a common ground. A marriage is a marriage of two different total personalities. You don't suddenly become twins when you marry. The mind thinks differently. My wife cannot and doesn't have any interest in computers. I love computers, love to analyze. But it's a difference. All my children pick it up except her. And so she said that's not her line. But there are different lines. She's tremendous at cooking. There's no bread like Amy's bread. Homemade bread. I can't cook. I can cook to a certain extent, but you know, she cooks better. And so that's her department. And then she has a different role that I don't have. She has a certain compassion for people. And she would want to do things for people. And so I release her to do what she wants. And she wants to help around and do things. So release her to do what she wants. And so we negotiate. So sometimes I say, look here, don't overdo it on this side. Don't neglect the children. Right? You can do this, but please give this time to the children. So we negotiate. And we have what I call a mutual understanding. So that she could be helping. She loves to help a lot of people. And I say, look, I don't have that much time with the children. And we need to negotiate with the children are not neglected and help. I feel people don't realize how much she has helped. When she is pregnant, she's teaching in Sunday school. When the child is born, she holds the child in one hand and she's teaching. People don't realize the commitment that she has to the Sunday school and the price that's being paid. And many times when I look and say, wow, you know, don't you have time for the children? And most of the time she's preparing, doing Sunday school material all the time, doing the work of ministry. And so we negotiate. I say, look, yeah, I got a call, you got a call. But one of us had to give more time to the family. So cut down on that side. Spend a little bit more time on the family here. Children are growing up, they need guidance here, guidance there. They need extra tuition at home and on this area. So we negotiate, we come to a mutual agreement, then we flow together. That's important. So there will be common grounds that you can find that you can flow together. Now as we conclude, we want to see the ideal family, which has all the five qualities. The book of Ruth, please. Let's turn to the book of Ruth. And we see in the relationship between Ruth and Boaz that all these qualities are there. First of all, Ruth and Boaz are not worthy. They are both committed to the Lord. And then they have negotiated how third parties are involved in their relationship, and Boaz and Ruth doesn't mind. Let's look at the book of Ruth. It's just after the book of Judges. And we see a particular relationship that both of them are committed to the Lord. They love the Lord. Boaz was not a worldly man. He was a generous man. Although he was a rich man, he loved to give and loved to share. He's well known for his generosity. You can see in his attitude, even before he knew Ruth personally, in chapter 2, you can see in verse 4, this is the type of man Boaz was. Boaz said, when he met the reapers, he said, "The Lord be with you." Now, don't you think that's a man who loves God? He greets you with the Lord's name. "Blessed be the Lord be with you." So Boaz was the type of person who was not worldly. He was a spiritual man who loved the Lord. Then in verse 5, Boaz said, "Whose young woman is this?" Now he doesn't know her yet. They said, "It is a young Moabite woman." And then Ruth said, "Please let me glean among the reapers." Verse 8, look at how Boaz is generous. He said, "You can glean among and pick up grain here." And not only that, he said, "Don't go to any other place. Just be here. We will provide all here for you." Look at how generous he was. And then in verse 9, not only that, he said, "When you're thirsty, you can drink with my young people here, my workers." He's not a selfish man, not a worldly man, very generous man. And she's just a stranger. And not only that, in verse 14, when it was makan time, meal time, Boaz called for Ruth. Said, "Ruth, come and join us for a meal." This was the kind of person he was. And besides that, in verse 16, privately he told the workers, he said, "Purposely let some grain fall so that she can pick it up." Look at his generosity. He's a wonderful man. Now, about his third party relationship. See here, Ruth was not against her taking care of her mother-in-law, but he commended her. In verse 11, he says, chapter 2, "It has been fully reported to me all that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband, and how you have left your father and your mother in the land of your birth, and have come to a people whom you did not know before. The Lord will repay your work." So Boaz was a very good man. He take care of third parties. He was not threatened when third parties come into a relationship, even before he knew Ruth. And in chapter 3, after Ruth has proposed to Boaz, of all things, Boaz did not just think about Ruth. Boaz remembered Ruth's mother. And verse 15, chapter 3, verse 15, bring the shawl that is on you and hold it. And when she held it, he measured 6 ephahs of barley and laid it on her. Verse 17, she said, these 6 ephahs of barley he gave me, for he said to me, do not go empty handed to your mother-in-law. See, Boaz was a generous man. He was not selfish, only he wants a wife. Neither was Ruth. Ruth was a person who was not only thinking about her family, she wants to take care of her mother-in-law of all things. So third parties were never a threat to their relationship, even as it was beginning. For their love in each other was secure. Besides that, the next area is the price that they pay for each other. I want you to know that although it looks as if Ruth initiated the relationship, Boaz paid a great price for the relationship. It was not easy work for him too. He has to go and meet the elders of the city, and he has to stand in danger of being disgraced himself. To enter that relationship with Ruth, it was not one-sided. It was not like one person doing 99% of the work. Ruth may have done her part, but after Ruth has done her part, Boaz told her, now I will do my part. And he purposely, in verse 1, chapter 4, went up to the gate, sat down there, behold the near kinsman of whom Boaz had spoken, and he said, come aside, friend, sit here. Verse 2, take 10 elders. And then he says, do you want to redeem the land that belonged to Elimelech? The person said yes. And say, in the agreement, you also have to take Ruth. The man says, no. And then Boaz, in public, said, in verse 9, you are witnesses this day that I have bought all that was Elimelech's and all that was Chilion's and Mahlon's from the hand of Naomi. Whatever Ruth the Moabitess, the wife of Mahlon, I have acquired as my wife, to raise up the name of the dead on his inheritance. Now that was very generous of him. You know why people don't like to follow that custom? It's because their child that they have doesn't belong to them. It follows the other person's lineage. It was like having a child that was not really yours. That was how generous he was. He was not selfish, a selfish person. He was very giving. And he paid a price. The reason why the other person didn't want to take Ruth was, as mentioned here in verse 6, he says, I will ruin my inheritance. Look at verse 6. I will ruin my inheritance. So we know that Boaz also paid a price to marry Ruth. Just as Ruth paid a price to marry Boaz. She really went all the way. Which woman you want go at midnight, lie down at a person's feet and say, you know, marry me? In danger of having said no in her face and embarrassment. She paid a price, Boaz paid a price, and they were committed to one another. And if you watch carefully here, the third party that came, the mother-in-law Naomi, became a blessing to both of them. And Naomi was a good third party because she encouraged the relationship, took care of the child, and she was rejoicing in all these blessings on Ruth and Boaz. So here is an example that we have that fulfill all the 5 qualities of family problems we consider. You'll find in the relationship of Ruth and Boaz, although in their situation, there was a tremendous age difference. As you can see, Boaz all the time called her my daughter. Now suddenly, not more my daughter became my wife. So we know there's an age difference between the two. There were a lot of physical barriers, a lot of different things that would have caused it impossible for a relationship to exist.
Yet they transcend all the barriers. And as far as the children are concerned, they have all the principles stretched out, the personalities stretched out. They have good personality. They were both very giving, very sharing, and spiritual, unselfish. All these qualities that were there, and they had a tremendous relationship together. And out of that relationship came David, the son of Jesse, a great one in Israel. So we praise God that many of those future men of God and women of God, they rest back on family foundations. There's nothing like a solid family foundation. Even for some of us who have not had the opportunity of a Christian home, isn't it wonderful to come into contact with families that receive you with their open arms? And they become your nuclear families. And you become established in learning fatherly love, motherly love, and family love. And from there, be able to launch forth your ministry. Be able to be secure knowing that God has extended your family so that there are many disciples of Jesus who are your brothers, your sisters, your fathers, your mothers, and your daughters and your sons in the Lord. And you could flow into the extent that God wants you. In the end, you, as you look back in God's mirror, and as you come closer and closer to the day you meet with the Lord Jesus, you can only know one thing. You have become more like God. And that's the purpose of a family relationship. That through the linking of human lives, we understand the nature of God. We understand the love of God. We understand what true love is in God. Let's go to God in prayer.